A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He grew up in Ireland, loves comedy with a sarcastic deadpan edge, pranks, engineered social awkwardness, people like Aubrey Plaza, Sacha Baron Cohen, Dom Jolly, Kevin Novak, Louis Theroux. He tried Israeli comedy, found some of it lands, but a lot of the slapstick doesn't connect. American stand-up often feels like it's speaking to a cultural context he's not part of. And he's asking, to what extent do different people and cultures actually have different comedy preferences? Are there archetypes or groups that researchers have mapped out? And where in the world is comedy most celebrated? And where is it most frowned upon? There's a lot to dig into here.
The first thing I'd say is the question itself is a bit of a Rorschach test, because you can approach it through psychology, anthropology, linguistics, even political science, and each lens gives you a different answer. But they all agree on one thing: humor is not universal. What makes someone laugh in Dublin is not what makes someone laugh in Tokyo or Tel Aviv or Buenos Aires.
Which feels obvious when you say it out loud. But I think people still imagine laughter as this primal universal thing.
Right. And it is primal in the sense that the physical act of laughter is hardwired. You see it in congenitally deaf and blind children. They laugh without ever having heard laughter. But what triggers it? That's entirely learned. There was a big cross-cultural study by Rod Martin and his colleagues. They developed something called the Humor Styles Questionnaire. They found four broad styles: affiliative, self-enhancing, aggressive, and self-defeating. And the distribution of those styles varies massively by culture.
Wait, walk me through those four.
Affiliative humor is the bonding kind, telling jokes to make people laugh, reduce tension, connect. Self-enhancing is using humor as a coping mechanism, keeping a humorous outlook even when things are tough. Aggressive humor is sarcasm, teasing, put-downs, using humor to criticize or manipulate. And self-defeating is making yourself the butt of the joke, putting yourself down to get approval.
Daniel's whole deadpan sarcastic prankster toolkit that's landing mostly in the aggressive and affiliative overlap zone.
And here's where culture comes in. Western individualist cultures, North America, UK, Ireland, Australia, they score higher on aggressive and self-enhancing humor. East Asian collectivist cultures tend to score lower on aggressive humor and higher on self-defeating and affiliative styles. There's a paper from 2019 by Zhang, Li, and Ho that looked at humor across 15 countries and found that in collectivist societies, humor that disrupts group harmony is genuinely socially costly in a way it isn't in Dublin or New York.
Which explains why a lot of American stand-up, the confrontational, I'm going to say the uncomfortable thing style, feels alien if you didn't grow up marinating in that cultural value system.
It's not just values, it's also about what linguists call pragmatic conventions. In high-context cultures, Japan, Korea, much of the Arab world, a lot of meaning is carried by context and implication. So humor tends to be more subtle, more wordplay-based, more situational. In low-context cultures, Germany, the Netherlands, the US, humor is more explicit, more direct, more what you see is what you get.
The German comedy scene being famously...
There's actually a running joke in comparative humor studies that Germans are the control group for whether a joke is funny.
Of course there are.
There was a 2023 study published in the Journal of Cross-Cultural Psychology that specifically compared German and British humor appreciation. British participants rated self-deprecating and absurdist humor significantly higher. German participants preferred humor based on incongruity resolution, jokes with a clear logical twist. The British were happier sitting in ambiguity.
British comedy is basically a national sport of not saying what you mean and watching people squirm.
Irish comedy, I'd argue, takes that even further. There's a whole literary tradition there, Swift, Wilde, Flann O'Brien, that weaponizes deadpan in a way that's culturally specific. The Irish comic voice often operates in what the writer Fintan O'Toole calls the gap between the said and the meant. It's a colonial legacy thing, partly. When you can't speak directly to power, you develop irony as a survival mechanism.
Because it suggests the preference isn't just aesthetic, it's baked into historical experience.
Humor preferences are downstream of history. Eastern European humor, for example, intensely dark, absurdist, gallows humor. You don't produce Kafka and Havel and Moroyek in a culture that's had an easy century.
If we're mapping archetypes, Daniel asked about that. What do the researchers actually find? Are there clusters?
There are a few major typologies. The most cited is probably the one from a 2011 paper by Martin and Ford, building on earlier work by Roosh and others. They identify three main humor dimensions: incongruity, resolution, nonsense, and sexual or aggressive content. Different cultures weight these differently. But the richer framework is the one that maps humor to Hofstede's cultural dimensions: power distance, individualism versus collectivism, uncertainty avoidance, masculinity versus femininity, long-term orientation, indulgence versus restraint.
Which, for people who haven't memorized Gerd Hofstede's life work, basically measures how cultures differ on things like hierarchy, group loyalty, comfort with ambiguity, and so on.
And here's where it gets predictive. High-powered distance cultures, Malaysia, Mexico, much of the Arab world, tend to prefer humor that doesn't challenge authority. Jokes flow downward, not upward. In low-powered distance cultures, Denmark, New Zealand, Israel, humor is a great leveler. You can make fun of the boss, the prime minister, anyone.
Which is why Israeli humor can feel abrasive if you're not used to it. The lack of deference is the point.
Israel is a fascinating case. It's low power distance, high in-group collectivism, and also what Hofstede would call highly indulgent. So you get this mix where humor is aggressive, direct, often gallows, adjacent because of the security situation, but also incredibly warm within the in-group. The classic Israeli comic archetype is the kibbutznik, who'll insult you to your face and then drive you to the airport at 4A.
That's basically my experience of every taxi ride in Jerusalem.
The slapstick Daniel mentioned, that's an interesting cultural signal. Slapstick tends to be more popular in cultures with higher uncertainty avoidance. Physical comedy has clear cause and effect. Someone slips on a banana peel. The outcome is immediate and unambiguous. It doesn't require the audience to sit with interpretive discomfort.
Whereas deadpan requires you to not know if it's a joke for several seconds.
That's torture if you're in a culture that values clarity and certainty. There's a reason. France, high uncertainty avoidance, has a rich tradition of farce and physical theater, but also a strong absurdist countercurrent. The tension is productive.
Daniel asked about places where comedy is most celebrated and most frowned upon. Let's go there!
The UK is the obvious heavyweight. The comedy industry there, between television, radio, live circuit, streaming, is proportionally enormous. Something like 10,000 working comedians in a country of 67 million. Edinburgh Fringe alone hosts over 3,000 comedy shows every August. The BBC has a legal mandate to produce comedy. It's embedded in the cultural infrastructure.
The US obviously has the commercial engine. Netflix specials, comedy clubs in every city, SNL as an institution.
Though the US is more commercially driven and less state-supported. The interesting outlier is actually Japan. Japan has a massive comedy industry, manzai, ORI, a whole ecosystem of variety shows and comedy duos, but it's almost entirely domestic. Japanese comedy doesn't export well, and they don't seem bothered by that. It's a self-contained universe.
What about the other end? Where is comedy constrained?
The most studied case is probably China. The state has an explicit regulatory framework for what humor is permissible. Xi Jinping's administration has cracked down on satirical content, especially anything targeting officials or party ideology. There was a 2021 directive from the National Radio and Television Administration that basically banned effeminate and vulgar comedy. Comedians self-censor heavily.
It's not just authoritarian regimes. Some cultures just don't valorize humor the same way.
In some highly religious societies, humor that mocks sacred things is taboo, not just legally, but socially. Saudi Arabia has a growing stand-up scene, but it's heavily circumscribed. You can joke about traffic, marriage, daily frustrations, but not religion, not the royal family, not gender roles in any serious way. The red lines are bright and internalized.
There's a difference between state censorship and social norm, but the effect is similar. A narrower bandwidth for what comedy can be.
Sometimes it's subtler than censorship. Germany, for example, not repressed, but there's a cultural earnestness. A 2022 survey by the Allensbach Institute found that 60% of Germans said they appreciate humor in daily life, compared to 84% of Brits. It's not that Germans don't have humor, it's that they compartmentalize it. Humor belongs in designated funny times, not diffused through everyday interaction.
The scheduled laughter approach.
Versus the Irish model, where you can't order a coffee without navigating three layers of irony.
As someone who has watched Daniel order coffee, yes.
There's a deeper question here about what humor is actually for. Anthropologists have been arguing about this for decades. One camp says it's social bonding. Laughter synchronizes groups, reduces tension, signals affiliation. Another camp says it's cognitive play, pattern recognition and violation, the pleasure of spotting incongruity. A third says it's a dominance display, humor as a way of negotiating status.
The real answer is probably all three, in different proportions depending on where you are.
The evolutionary psychologist Robin Dunbar. He's the guy who found that human social group size correlates with neocortex ratio. He argues that laughter replaced grooming as the primary social bonding mechanism in humans. Grooming is one-to-one, slow, doesn't scale. Laughter is one-to-many, instantaneous, and releases endorphins in everyone who hears it.
Which means comedy is literally a public health intervention.
In a way, yes. There's a growing body of research on humor and resilience. A 2024 meta-analysis in Psychological Bulletin looked at 37 studies across 19 countries and found that humor-based interventions significantly reduced cortisol levels and self-reported stress, with effect sizes comparable to mindfulness interventions.
My leaf medicine and comedy are basically the same thing.
Please don't.
That resilience function, that's where culture really bites. If your humor style doesn't match your cultural environment, it's not just that you're not laughing. You're missing a coping mechanism.
There's a concept in cross-cultural psychology called the cultural fit hypothesis, the idea that well-being depends partly on how well your personal traits match the prevailing cultural values. A 2018 study by Delair-Snyder and colleagues found that emotional fit with one's culture predicted life satisfaction better than individual emotional experience alone, and humor style is part of that emotional repertoire.
If you're an Irish deadpan ironist dropped into a slapstick culture, you're not just bored, you're adrift.
It cuts both ways. Someone whose humor is broad and physical and warm might feel utterly alienated in a Dublin pub where every sentence is a test.
Daniel mentioned specific comedians. Aubrey Plaza, Sacha Baron Cohen, Dom Joey, Louis Theroux. If you look at that list, what's the through line?
They're all practitioners of what I'd call undercover comedy. The humor comes from inserting a constructed persona into a real social situation and letting the awkwardness generate the comedy. Baron Cohen is the extreme version, Borat, Ali G, Bruno, but Dom Joly pioneered the same thing with Trigger Happy TV, and Louis Theroux does a gentler, more journalistic version of it. Aubrey Plaza does it within the container of talk shows and interviews.
It's comedy as social experiment. The audience's pleasure comes from watching the norm violation and the real person's response to it.
That's a very specific cultural taste. It requires an audience that enjoys vicarious discomfort. The Germans, to return to our control group, tend not to love this. There's a reason the German version of The Office, Stromberg, is much more overtly comedic and less cringe-based than the British original. The cringe comedy spectrum maps pretty neatly onto uncertainty avoidance.
What about pranks specifically? Daniel loves pranks, and that feels like its own category.
Pranks are interesting because they're one of the oldest forms of humor. You find prank traditions in virtually every culture, but the flavor varies enormously. The French have a whole tradition of poisson d'avril, April fish, which is gentle and communal. In parts of Latin America, the Dia de los Santos Inocentes has a prank tradition that's similar. But then you've got cultures where pranks are more aggressive, more about establishing dominance.
The American fraternity prank versus the Japanese, baka shoji, same activity, completely different social meaning.
In some cultures, pranks are just not done. There's a politeness threshold. In Japan, public embarrassment is so socially costly that a prank that humiliates someone isn't funny, it's cruel. The humor has to be structured so that no one loses face.
Which brings us to stand-up. Daniel said a lot of American stand-up doesn't connect for him. I get that. American stand-up is built on a very specific architecture. The individual on stage. The confessional mode. The assumption that personal authenticity is inherently interesting.
The history matters here. Modern stand-up as we know it really crystallized in the U.S. in the 1950s and 60s with Mort Saul, Lenny Bruce, Dick Gregory comedians who positioned themselves as truth-tellers speaking to power. That model, the comedian as social critic, the stage as pulpit, is deeply American. It draws on the same cultural well as the preacher, the politician, the self-help guru.
Whereas British stand-up, especially the alternative comedy wave of the 80s, was more about puncturing that very idea. The comedian as inadequate, not as oracle.
Irish stand-up takes that even further. The Irish comic tradition, Dylan Moran, Tommy Tiernan, Aisling Bia, often treats the very concept of a confident person on stage as inherently absurd. The humor comes from undermining the format.
Moran's whole thing is basically a man having a breakdown in front of you, but make it elegant.
And if you grow up with that as your baseline, American stand-up can feel weirdly earnest. Like someone showing up to a party in a suit when everyone else is in jeans.
Daniel also asked about Israeli comedy. He mentioned Kupa Rashid as something that works for him.
Kupa Rashid, Checkout, is a great example. It's a workplace sitcom set in a supermarket, and it's got this deadpan absurdist streak that's unusual for Israeli mainstream comedy. Most Israeli comedy is broader, louder, more physical. Eretz Neheteret, the big satire show, is fast and aggressive. The classic Israeli comedy film, like the Lemon Popsicle series or the works of Asi Dayan, tends toward the broad and the body.
There's a cultural history there too, right? Israeli humor was shaped by the pioneer ethos, the kibbutz, the army.
By waves of immigration. You got Ashkenazi humor from Eastern Europe. Dark, intellectual, wordplay. Heavy. Sephardic and Mizrahi humor from North Africa and the Middle East, more physical, more communal, often built around family dynamics. Russian-speaking immigrants brought a whole other tradition of literary absurdism. Israeli comedy is a fusion cuisine.
Like fusion cuisine, it can be chaotic and uneven.
The slapstick Daniel doesn't enjoy. That's partly the Mizrahi comedy tradition, which draws from a Mediterranean physical comedy vocabulary, and partly the general Israeli preference for high-energy, high-volume interaction. Israelis tend to be what communication scholars call high-involvement conversationalists. Overlap, interruption, loudness. These aren't seen as rude, they're seen as engaged. Comedy reflects that.
If you're Irish, where conversation is a precision instrument and silence is part of the joke,
then Israeli comedy can feel like being shouted at by someone who's not sure if they're telling a joke or starting an argument.
That's basically every family dinner I've ever attended.
What's interesting is that Israeli comedy exports surprisingly well for a small language market. Fauda isn't comedy, but shows like The Baker and the Beauty, Steisel, even Checkout, they've found international audiences. I think it's because underneath the cultural specificity, the themes are universal. Family, status, love, death. The comedy is the local dialect, but the grammar is human.
Okay, so we've talked about cultural differences, archetypes, specific countries. Let me ask the question Daniel kind of embedded in all this. Is there a best way to appreciate comedy from a culture that's not your own?
I think the first step is exactly what Daniel is doing, recognizing that the disconnect is cultural, not a failure of the comedy or of the audience. The second step is what anthropologists call suspending aesthetic judgment, long enough to understand the function. What is this comedy doing for the people who love it?
Instead of, is this funny to me, ask what is this telling me about what matters to these people?
Sometimes the answer is, this comedy is not for me, and that's fine, I'm not the audience. The idea that all comedy should be universally accessible is itself a very culturally specific assumption. It comes from a globalized, American-influenced media environment that treats universal appeal as the highest value.
The marvelization of humor.
Everyone gets the quip. No one is left out. No one is offended. And no one is particularly delighted either. It's the comedic equivalent of beige wallpaper.
There's a tension there. Comedy that's too culturally specific risks being incomprehensible. Comedy that's too universal risks being nothing at all.
The sweet spot, I think, is specificity that reveals universality. You watch an Irish comedy about a small town funeral, and you've never been to a small Irish town, but you recognize the family dynamics, the unspoken tensions, the way grief and absurdity coexist. The details are local. The experience is human.
Like Derry Girls. Set in 1990s Northern Ireland during the Troubles. But the core comedy is girls being terrible to each other and to everyone else, which is legible anywhere.
Derry Girls is a perfect example. The political context is hyper-specific. You'd miss half the jokes if you don't know the history. But the character dynamics are so strong that it works even without that knowledge. You just get a different experience. A richer one if you know the context, but not an empty one if you don't.
Daniel asked about countries where comedy is particularly celebrated. We talked about the UK, the US, Japan. Any others worth flagging?
India is having a massive stand-up boom right now. The last decade has been extraordinary. Comics like Veer Das, Zakir Khan, Kenny Sebastian are playing to thousands of people. An Indian comedy is fascinating because it's navigating multiple language markets, caste dynamics, religious sensitivities, and a rapidly changing urban culture all at once.
Australia has always punched above its weight in comedy.
Australia is interesting because it combines British deadpan with American confidence and something uniquely Australian, a kind of laconic irreverence. The comedy doesn't try too hard. It's the national allergy to pretension.
Bettol Poppy Syndrome as comedy.
And New Zealand takes that even further. Flight of the Conchords is basically what happens when you combine extreme talent with extreme reluctance to appear talented.
What about the most serious places? We touched on China, Saudi Arabia. Anywhere else that stands out?
Singapore is an interesting case. Very low tolerance for public satire, especially political satire. The government has used defamation laws to discourage comedians from touching sensitive topics. There's a comedy scene, but it operates within very clear boundaries. The result is a lot of observational humor about food, public transport, and family, which are rich topics, but the absence of political comedy is conspicuous.
North Korea, obviously. Though at that point we're not talking about comedy preferences. We're talking about a total absence of anything recognizable as a comedy ecosystem.
Though even there, humor exists. It's just entirely private, entirely oral, and entirely subversive. Jokes about the leadership circulate in whispers. That's true of every authoritarian context. Humor goes underground, but it doesn't die. It can't die. It's too fundamental to human cognition.
The cockroach of human expression.
That's grim, but not wrong.
Let me pull on something you said earlier about humor as a coping mechanism. If different cultures have different humor styles, does that mean they're coping with different things, or coping with the same things differently?
Both, I think. Every culture has the same basic stressors: mortality, status anxiety, romantic rejection, family conflict, economic precarity. But the weight and shape of those stressors vary. An Israeli is more likely to be coping with security anxiety, a Japanese person with social conformity pressure, an American with identity and authenticity anxiety. And the humor evolves to address the specific flavor of distress.
The humor of a culture is almost a diagnostic tool. Show me what you laugh at and I'll show you what hurts.
That's beautifully put. And it's why comedy that travels across cultures often does so by tapping into the universal stressors underneath the local ones. You might not know what it's like to live under constant rocket threat, but you know what it's like to be scared and absurd at the same time. The best comedy finds that connective tissue.
Daniel's list of comedians: Plaza, Baron Cohen, Dom Jolie, Novak, Thoreau. They're all doing versions of that. Baron Cohen's characters are extreme, but the discomfort he creates, the social anxiety of not knowing how to respond to someone who's violating every norm, that's universal.
Dom Jolie's giant phone bit from Trigger Happy TV. It's funny in any language. A man shouting into a comically oversized phone in a public place. The humor is the violation of public decorum, and every culture has public decorum.
Though what counts as a violation varies.
The giant phone works everywhere because the violation is legible. Everyone understands that shouting in public is disruptive. But subtler pranks might not translate. A prank based on linguistic ambiguity, for instance, only works if the audience understands the language well enough to get the double meaning.
Which brings up the question of whether there's such a thing as a universal joke.
The closest researchers have found is what they call incongruity resolution humor with benign violation. Something that's surprising but not threatening, wrong but not harmful. A baby laughing. A dog wearing a hat. These things get smiles across cultures. But a joke requires language and context, and those are never fully universal.
The dog in a hat is basically the lowest common denominator of comedy.
There's nothing wrong with that. But it's not what Daniel is asking about. He's asking about the stuff that's culturally specific and why it doesn't travel.
To pull this together, what are the archetypes? What are the groups?
If I had to map the landscape, I'd say there are maybe 6 or 7 major clusters. 1, the Anglo-ironic cluster, UK, Ireland, Australia, New Zealand. Deadpan, self-deprecating, comfortable with ambiguity, hostile to earnestness. 2, the American expressive cluster. High energy, confessional, individualistic, the comedian as truth-teller. 3. The East Asian contextual cluster. Japan, Korea, Taiwan, subtle, wordplay, heavy, face-saving humor that bonds without disrupting. 4. The Mediterranean physical cluster. Italy, Greece, Israel, parts of Latin America. Loud, bodily, family-centered humor as social warmth. 5. The Nordic dry cluster. Sweden, Denmark, Norway. Understated, absurdist, dark humor as a quiet agreement that life is absurd. 6. The Eastern European gallows cluster. Dark, literary, political, humor as survival. 7. The South Asian performative cluster. Indian stand-up, Bollywood comedy, energetic, multilingual, navigating tradition and modernity.
That's a useful map. And most people, I guess, are a blend of adjacent clusters.
Individuals within a culture vary enormously. The clusters are central tendencies, not straitjackets. There are Israelis who love deadpan. There are Brits who love slapstick. Culture gives you a starting distribution, not a destiny.
Daniel's experience, Irish sensibility, living in Israel, consuming American and British media. He's navigating at least 3 clusters simultaneously. No wonder some things land and some don't.
That's the immigrant comedy experience in a nutshell. You're always code-switching, always translating, always calibrating, and you notice things that natives don't notice because they've never had to.
The gift and curse of the outsider.
Which is also, not coincidentally, the perspective of a lot of great comedians. The immigrant, the outsider, the person who doesn't quite fit, they see the absurdities that everyone else has normalized.
Maybe the ideal comedy consumer is someone who's permanently slightly out of place.
Uncomfortable in every culture, but in a productive way.
That's basically the title of my memoir.
I'd read it.
Thank you for that.
One thing we haven't touched on. Daniel mentioned Louis Theroux in his list, and Theroux is not a comedian in the traditional sense. He's a documentarian. But his style, the soft-spoken, faux-naive questions that make people reveal themselves, is a form of comedy. It's humor as investigative method.
That's the British tradition of the interviewer as comic foil. Theroux learned it partly from his father, Paul Theroux, but also from the whole culture of BBC personality-led documentary. It's comedy adjacent.
It connects to what we said about undercover comedy. The persona is the instrument. Theroux's persona, polite, curious, slightly awkward, disarms people in a way that a more confrontational interviewer couldn't. The comedy comes from the gap between his mildness and the extremity of what he's uncovering.
It's the same mechanism as Sacha Baron Cohen, but at a completely different temperature. Cohen is boiling water. Theroux is room temperature water that somehow still burns you.
Both are very British approaches, even though Baron Cohen's characters are international. The method, the constructed persona, the patience, the willingness to be the butt of the joke while also being in control, that's a British comic sensibility.
Daniel's list is basically a tour of that sensibility in different registers.
Which makes sense given the Irish starting point. The Irish and British comedy traditions are distinct, but they share a common ancestor in the music hall tradition and a common allergy to sincerity presented straight. The American tradition, by contrast, often treats sincerity as the whole point.
The American stand-up special is basically a secular sermon. The British comedy panel show is basically people trying to make each other laugh while pretending not to care if they do.
The Irish version is people making each other laugh while pretending not to be making a joke at all.
That's the deadpan inheritance. The straight face is the whole art form.
There's a great line from the Irish comedian Dylan Moran. I'm not a comedian, I'm a man who talks. That's the pose. The denial of performance is the performance.
If you don't grow up with that convention, you might watch Dylan Moran and think, is this guy okay? Does he need help?
Whereas an Irish audience knows, the more he looks like he's falling apart, the more control he has.
Comedy as the art of looking like you're losing while winning.
Which is, now that I think about it, a pretty good description of Irish history.
We've covered a lot. Let me try to bring it home. To the question of whether different cultures have different comedy preferences, the answer is unambiguously yes. The research is robust, the typologies are useful, and the differences show up in everything from joke structure to performance style, to the social function of laughter.
To the question of archetypes. There are clusters, they're real, but they're starting points, not boxes. The Anglo-Ironic, the American Expressive, the East Asian Contextual, the Mediterranean Physical, the Nordic Dry, the Eastern European Gallows, the South Asian Performative. Most people are blends.
To the question of where comedy is most celebrated and most constrained, the UK is the institutional champion, the US is the commercial champion, Japan is the domestic champion. On the constrained end, authoritarian regimes suppress political comedy, and some cultures simply don't valorize humor as a default social mode.
We're looking at you.
Germany, the scheduled laughter capital of Europe.
The deeper point, and I think this is what the prompt is really driving at, is that comedy preferences aren't just aesthetic, they're diagnostic. They tell you what a culture values, what it fears, what it's coping with. Show me what makes the people laugh, and I'll show you what keeps them up at night.
For someone like Daniel, navigating multiple comedy cultures, the gift is that he can triangulate. He can see the shape of each tradition more clearly because he's standing outside all of them.
The permanent outsider, laughing in translation.
Which is maybe its own comedy archetype.
The ninth cluster. The cosmopolitan code switcher. Probably terrible at parties. Too busy analyzing the humor to enjoy it.
That's fair. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1950s, linguists working with speakers of Tijuca on the Brazilian-Colombian border discovered that the language requires evidentiality marking on every verb. Speakers must grammatically indicate how they know what they're saying, with separate suffixes for visual evidence, non-visual sensory evidence, hearsay, and logical inference. There are roughly 700 speakers of Tijuca alive today.
I feel like English could use some of that.
I'm pretty sure I saw it is not a grammatical category, Korn.
It should be. This has been My Weird Prompts with me, Korn.
Me, Herman Poppleberry. Produced by Hilbert Flemingtop. If you enjoyed this, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps other people find the show.
Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.